Good morning.
Blog Talk Radio.
Black Thought Radio Show. Good morning. Welcome to the Business Black Belt Radio Show. This is Burke Franklin, where every Friday we get into talking with angel investors, VC investors, experts in business development or financing, or an entrepreneur who offers some keen insights into building your business. I'm about the real deal, the real thing they're really thinking, not just the academic stuff that sounds good. There's no slant to it. I'm just trying to get you the real, you know, what you need to know to really build your business for real in a real world. What it's all about. And today I'm talking with Matt Romney of the Kunzler Law Group in Salt Lake City. He's an attorney who specializes in patents and trademarks and business formation. He's got more than 10 years' experience in business law and business financing. He used to work for some VCs and graduated from Harvard. And so this guy's got a lot of insight into setting up your company. That's what today's subject is about, is what's the best way to structure your business and, you know, structure business to attract financing. What do you need to do to be really ready for financing that way? And also, if you've got an established company, you haven't needed financing yet or before, and now what you want to do is you want to attract financing, are there some things you might need to consider? I'm sure you do. What do you need to change, or how do you need to set the business up the best way to attract the financing? Matt, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the first question I want to know, since your last name is Romney, how close are you to Mitt?
Oh, I'm a distant cousin. I always joked with people when he was running his campaign that I wasn't going to be invited onto Air Force One anytime soon.
Ah, tragic. Oh, well, so you can't just call him up and say, hey, Uncle Mitt, I need some cash. Can you help me out?
Yeah, no, I doubt he's going to be funneling cash my way either.
Oh well, nice try. So we can give everybody through you, they get access to Mitt and some investment banking. But anyway, we'll figure out how they can get their own investment banking the best way. They know people around. You know, the thing is, we've got investors all around us. That's the funny thing. There's groups in town. I don't care what town you're in. There's meetup groups. There's angel groups. There's entrepreneurial groups, and investors go to these things. So I think if you have your business plan ready to go, your business is structured properly and all that stuff, you know, you stand up and everybody gets a chance to give them a little 30-second pitch, someone's going to find you. They're going to say, hey, I'm interested in your deal. And so there's investors everywhere. So I really wouldn't worry about having to look for the right silver bullet and find an investor. But all that said, let's talk about, like, where do we start with structuring a business? I mean, the first thing that comes to mind to me is it a corporation? Is it an LLC, an S-Corp, C-Corp? Can you, without getting too far down the rabbit hole, give us an idea of what's the best way to go?
Well, let me just say, first, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, finding investment is, you know, really a function of how well you've structured that business plan and how well the investor can see that you're ready for investment. And I think that structuring the business is one of those very important elements. So let's talk about that. I think that most people come to me and for them it's a question between a limited liability company or a corporation. And, you know, I think everyone knows to some extent that that question is really determined by, you know, the tax consequences that you're looking for by choosing your corporate structure. I like to sit them down a little bit and walk them through a couple of questions, three questions. The first is, who will hold the equity in the company? The second is, how are you going to cash those people out? And the third is, what do you all want to do about the profits and losses of the company? So let's go through those a little bit. Who are going to hold the equity? If you're only going to have a few people holding equity in the company, then really the form doesn't matter all that much. It really hinges on other factors. But if you're going to have a lot of equity holders, that makes partnership taxation, which you would have in an LLC, a lot more complicated. It makes it, you know, nobody wants to deal with that accounting complication. And so I would steer you toward a corporation. There are a couple other things, like if you're going to be granting equity to employees, it's a lot easier to do. Everyone understands the implications a lot better in a corporation than in an LLC. You get a lot, employees will get a lot more favorable treatment under an incentive stock option under the Internal Revenue Code than they will in equity compensation structures under LLCs. So there are a number of things to keep in mind. I guess the other thing about investors is that generally they're going to prefer corporations because it's just easier to understand. So
can I back up a second? Because a couple questions loomed at me. Like I'm thinking, as I'm listening to this, I don't quite get what you're saying. Because just for example, I've got a couple of friends. We want to start a business. We're not thinking about financing yet. We've invented something. We want to build this business. Maybe we're starting a donut shop. It could be something simple. It could be a combination of a customer called. She was going to start a cleaners, a washing machine thing with beer in the back, which I thought was amusing. Anyway, so
okay.
An LLC is the cheapest, easiest, fastest way to go. You can do that online. You get the LLC, bada boom. You've got your limited liability company there. We can put in the documents, and we have a bunch of templates, I'm sure you do too, where we can say I own X percent, somebody else gets X percent, somebody else gets Z percent, right? And that's all simple. But if we're going to go out and raise capital, we need to get some money, we would be better off with a corporation because that way I own a certain number of shares of stock, you own certain number of shares of stock, and then we can sell other shares of stock to other people, and then we can have a pool of stock available to bring on new people, I presume. And then you said something about the equity compensation structure. When I hear all that, I think, whoa, go numb, you know, legalese sort of on me. Equity compensation structure in an LLC, what does that mean?
Okay, so let me take a step back. So you and your friend are starting a company, and if it's a donut shop, you know, it really kind of depends on accounting questions, and you should sit down with an accountant and decide, you know, what you want to do. But here's the thing. Most people aren't starting up donut shops and aren't, you know, that's not that complicated. It's when you start to introduce other things. So, for example, if you're a technology company and you know that you're going to need a couple years of investment before you're going to be able to get your product to market, then suddenly one of your big concerns is how do you attract investors? Well, there are a number of reasons why investors prefer corporations. From a tax perspective, they're easier to understand. They also are used to investing in corporations. And if you're seeking investment from sophisticated investors like funds, a lot of those funds can't invest in an LLC. So there are a number of reasons why investors prefer corporations. But like I said, it's also if you want to give stock options to employees, for example, to incentivize them to come work for the company while there aren't a lot of revenues, then the corporation is the way to go there, in my opinion, as well, because there are more favorable structures for them and it's easier for everyone to understand.
You can't do that with an LLC at all.
No, you can give equity compensation, to use the legalese again, you can give stock option-like things in an LLC, but it's harder for everyone to understand what the consequences of those are, and they're not exactly like stock options. And one of the ways that they're not like stock options is they don't have the, for example, like I said, you can give an incentive stock option in a corporation, which allows the employee when it gets to treat those gains as capital gains. Well, you can't do that in an LLC. So there are benefits for employees as well to having a corporation and getting a stock option rather than the equivalent in an LLC.
Okay. And so if someone's got an LLC, because I can imagine somebody listening and thinking, we started with an LLC, we're stuck, what do we do? You can convert easily to a corp, can't you?
Right. LLCs can convert relatively easily to a corporation tax-free. That's not a problem. If you started as an LLC and want to go to a corporation, that's a relatively easy transition. The same isn't true going back the other way, but we don't see that many people who want to go from a corporation to an LLC.
I can't imagine why one would want to do that. It seems like, all right, so corporation. Now the next question on corporation, do I do an S-corp or a C-corp? C-corp seems like it's way more trouble and double taxation, extra stuff. What's the difference there? What should I do?
Right. So, again, that's going to be you've identified exactly the principal issue there. If you're doing an S-corp, the reason you would do an S-corp is if you wanted to have partnership taxation, which would be the same type of taxation structure you would have in an LLC. But if you're going to have partnership taxation structure, there are very few instances where it makes sense to do an S-corp rather than just doing an LLC. There's a lot more flexibility in structuring an LLC, and the tax structure, the tax complications are going to be the same. There are also some limits in S-corporations as to who can own stock in an S-corporation. For the most part, they have to be individuals, although there are also some entities who can. But there are some limitations that make it complicated. For the most part, I would, my general advice would be to avoid an S corporation. If you want partnership taxation, do an LLC. Otherwise, go with a C corporation. You do have to deal with the double taxation, but let's talk about double taxation for a minute, because it comes down to how you're going to operate your business, right? I mean, if most of your income is going to be used to pay salaries, then you're not going to have a lot of income tax anyway, because, all of that will be deductible, right?
Yeah.
So I think that the double taxation thing is kind of the big boogeyman in the organization question, but in a lot of cases, it's really not that big of a deal, and other considerations should weigh more heavily.
Okay. So go with a C corp if you want. I was also say, so C corp, then where do you do it? I mean, I'm thinking, I've heard a lot about Delaware corporations, and somehow Delaware is the place to open a corporation. And why is Delaware so popular?
Well, Delaware is popular because a long time ago, Delaware committed themselves to being a very business-friendly state. And so they have a very well-developed and predictable corporate law that people like and that businesses like because it's very business-favorable. There are some other – because they've been doing it a long time, there are some other administrative advantages to the volume of companies that are incorporated there. It makes changes and amendments and things like that more efficient. And the other thing that investors like about it, especially if they have investments all over the company, is it's a lot easier for them to stay on top of things if they're dealing with one body of law rather than a different body of law with each investment, right? So that's why
I could say I only invest in Delaware corporations, because that way my legal knowledge can be focused. I was going to say constricted, but focused to, I just need to understand one bunch of laws. I don't have to figure out California and everywhere else.
And they don't need to worry about there being some booby trap hidden in the corporate code that they don't know about, right? So those are the reasons that people like Delaware. When talking about the jurisdiction of incorporation, where you want to incorporate your business, my starting point, notwithstanding the fact that investors generally like Delaware, my starting point is generally that you should incorporate in the state where the business has its principal place of business. And the reason for that is because it's generally going to be cheaper, right? I mean, if you incorporate somewhere else, you're still going to have to register to do business in the state where the principal place of business is in most cases. So you're just duplicating expense.
And paperwork and other stuff that I can imagine. And all this stuff is just time-consuming. It's not making the phone ring. It's not adding clicks to your website. It's not bringing in any money. It's just stuff.
Right, exactly. And so the reasons that it might make sense to incorporate somewhere else is the investor considerations we talked about with Delaware. If you have investors, if you know you're going to be seeking investment from funds and sophisticated investors who have multiple investments, you might think about Delaware. It might make sense up front to just incorporate there. The other thing to think about is it's pretty easy to, in most cases, to convert from a corporation in one state into a Delaware corporation later on. So that's always a possibility as well. The other thing to think about is there are a couple of states that, you know, like Nevada and Wyoming, and there are some other states who are really actively trying to attract companies to incorporate in their states. And so they're trying to develop favorable laws and favorable fees, you know, make it cheaper to incorporate and do business in their jurisdictions. So that's something to think about if your if your business is very cost sensitive on those fees. But in most cases, like I said, I would either do the state where the principal place of business is going to be, or in Delaware.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm thinking like Nevada. So what? Yeah, you know, I have a friend who's pitching Wyoming. I forget exactly why Wyoming has some attractive characteristics about it. I know Nevada, from what I understand, is, you know, if you incorporate Nevada, then you don't have to reveal who the ownership of the company is. So that can be all behind the veil. We could be a blind corporate Nevada corporation. So if you wanted to incorporate and you didn't want to have to reveal who owns the shares in the business, you go to Nevada. Is that true? Is that a good reason? Is that just some kind of stuff I read somewhere in some black hat email or something?
Right, and I'm not an expert on Nevada, but yeah, that's my understanding as well. The real question, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You know, is that – how many people are that worried about having a blind corporation that nobody knows who the owners are? I mean, at the end of the day, you know, in Delaware, you don't have to disclose that much about the owners either. I mean, really, you know, the certificate of incorporation is going to have the name of an incorporator on it, and that's about it, right? So, and that person may or may not be the people who are going to be directors later on. And then there are franchise tax filings and all of that stuff, and there will be different levels of information that you'll disclose. But, again, you know, I think that's way down the list on considerations for most companies. Now, for some companies, that's going to be a really important thing. But for most companies, I think that's going to be way down on the list of considerations when they're thinking about where to incorporate.
Well, I can imagine. Like, I read a thing recently. Like, New Mexico had a deal where, you know, they basically shield you from revealing who the shareholders are, who the management is. I can imagine that'd be great for asset protection. If you wanted some corporation to own your stuff, but you didn't want anybody to find you behind it, and that's a whole different. That's like a whole different deal. That's how we're talking about here.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, if the corporation does something illegal, it's not like that shield is going to hold up to a subpoena from a court, right? So, I mean, at the end of the day, I don't know how much extra protection that gives you. It just makes it a little harder.
Yeah. Okay. But I was at a, I think it was at a Keiretsu Forum meeting where they had a bunch of angels around the table. We're all sitting there, you know, and people are giving presentations. And, you know, they pay a lot of money to give a presentation. And one guy's up there, and he's talking and pitching. He's doing a really clever, it was an insurance company play that he wanted investors for, and he said he revealed that he's a Nevada corporation. Now, back to what you said earlier, he happened to be from Nevada, so I'll incorporate my own state, you know. So he incorporated Nevada, and one of the angels at the table said, you know, I would never invest in a Nevada corporation because you don't blah 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 have something about have to reveal your shareholders and ownership and management team and all that. And I want that. He says, I want to see that. I want that to be transparent. I don't want to invest in something like that. And it was incredible how it just, you know, it just popped this balloon, like boom, like right there. All of a sudden, this guy's deal was just dead. The whole room, any one of these guys in the room could have written most of them could have written a check to fund this guy's company. But it just went, you know, right there on the spot, it just died. And I thought, oh, my God, what a drag. But note to self, you know, incorporate Nevada at your peril like that, if these investors have that feeling about it, just killed it right there. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I don't know how common that sentiment is, but just the fact that it's out there. I mean, you know, disclosure is a big deal these days. People want transparency, and that does scare away a fair number of investors.
Well, and the thing is, I don't know how well-founded this guy's information really was. You know, maybe it was. But it's just amazing how one person can make an accusation. You know, so it wasn't even like innocent until proven guilty. I mean, and unfortunately, the guys pitching it didn't say, you know, well, hold it here, you know, not so fast, and defend themselves. They were caught flat-footed on that one, which I thought was really unfortunate. And I would just suggest if you're going to incorporate in a state that might have that, where you might trigger that investor sentiment, you better have a darn good answer for that question or a workaround to that objection. And
well, right, the ready answer, if you know, if you're incorporated in Nevada and run into that, is, you know, we're happy to convert our corporation into, you know, whatever state you want
right.
for the right price, right? I mean, so
if we incorporated in Delaware, would you invest? You know, that's like kind of the basic used car salesman response. You know, if we reincorporated in Delaware, would you be interested? And not let that be a stopper. That, it was really tragic.
Exactly.
That was really a showstopper for them. So California, just talk about that aside. We have a lot of customers in California. In California, I believe, in some polls or somewhere, has been elected or voted or suggested that it's the worst state in the entire country to do business in. And, you know, I'm in California, and I hear that, and I go, oh, it's kind of wince and cringe. What is our problem? Do you know much about California and how, like, what the hell's wrong with this picture?
Well, so, you know, that being said, there are a fair number of companies that incorporate in California. And the reason for that is that California actually makes it really hard to avoid their jurisdictional laws, you know, whether or not you're incorporated in California. If you're principal place of business is in California, and they make it really hard to avoid California law. And so there are a lot of corporations that do incorporate there. That being said, you know, California does have a lot of law where they're not in step with the rest of the country. A lot of employment law, you know, other issues where, you know, investors don't want to invest in California because, again, they feel like there are all these booby traps where they don't know what the implications are of investing in that company, and they're afraid something's going to pop up that doesn't make any sense for them, right? So that's the big problem with California for me.
They were just going to get gouged out of nowhere for no apparent reason. It's just some political thing that pulls the rug out from under you.
Well, yeah, not so much a political thing, but it's just that they don't understand the laws, and they know that California's laws are different than a lot of the norms across the country.
Yeah, it seems from what I gather, certainly with the employee policies, and we have an employee policy manual software product too, that, you know, a lot of California laws there are just, it's so employee favored, you know, so a company we're talking about, I take the side of the company. You know, to succeed, because I want the business to succeed, where the business owners and the entrepreneurs and the people who bet the farm on this thing, you know, their money and everybody else's on an invention or an innovation that I think the world can benefit from. I'm just making a kind of a broad so-called judgment on that, but you know, that's what we're about. You know, how can we help you get your thing out there and succeed and build a successful business around something you want to do? And so, but you can get the rug pulled out from under you by some, you know, by one, you know, bad apple, and California seems to favor the bad apple almost, which is, I don't know if that's a fair statement, but it seems like that sometimes. Anyway,
well,
right,
you know, like I said, one of the reasons Delaware is so popular is because businesses know that their law is business friendly, and I think they have the opposite impression of California law. You know, they think California law is more interested in protecting employees and customers and anyone but the business. And so I think that that's a perception out there that prevents a lot of people from incorporating in California. I think a lot of technology companies, who are the companies that I work most with, and we have a number of clients in California, and I think just about all of them are incorporated in Delaware.
Now you worked on the VC side for a while, didn't you? Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah. Like I've worked with I've represented both companies and venture capital funds in financing transactions. So yes, I've worked extensively with VC funds.
So you know how these guys think. So that would give you an advantage, I would think, working with entrepreneurs, because now you could help them be ready, prepared. What kind of other things do we need to consider? So I'm starting a business we have a couple of different places. One, either I'm starting a business from scratch and I got this great idea, or B, I got a business and it's been going okay or whatever. I've hit a bump and I want to raise some money. So we've covered the company structure part, and if someone's got an LLC and they want to raise money, and they can switch to a C-Corp easy enough. But so what else does someone need to really – have in place legally to really be attractive to the investors? Because you've been working with these VCs, and I'm sure they've sat in the presentations, and afterwards you'll sit around and say, okay, good idea. That guy doesn't have enough horsepower to pull this off. They need this, and the other thing, other T's crossed and I's dotted. What are those other things that people often miss that are just basic building blocks you have to have in place to even be on the playing field to get the money?
Yeah, sure. So let's stick with the formation and structure issue first, because I think that's one important thing that any investor, and especially VCs, are going to be looking at as they're evaluating investment. So a lot of people out there, they have this idea, they want to start a business, they just go online and file a certificate or articles of incorporation or formation for their LLC, for example, and they just leave it there. And then they go start doing their business and focusing on their product and everything, but they don't think about the structure of their business and corporate governance and some other things that are very important to have a properly organized business. So if you're starting a C corporation, for example, you file your certificate of incorporation. Well, generally, that's usually a pretty bare-bones document. The real governance of the company is done by what are called bylaws, right? And so the bylaws describe what powers the shareholders have and how shareholder meetings work and how shareholder votes work, and they describe how the board of directors work and how all that happens. They describe who the officers of the company are. That's where the real bare-bones of the governance of the company is. But I can't tell you how many people I run into who have this company and they want me to help them through an investment transaction, but they don't even have bylaws in place. You know, the same thing happens on the LLC side. Somebody goes and files, you know, articles of organization, but they don't have an operating agreement in place. Well, so an investor comes along and looks at this company, and they have no idea whether anything that company has done from formation until now was ever authorized by the company or who authorized it, right? And whether that's subject to challenge later on. You know, that causes two problems. The first is, they don't know if the company is safe to invest in because they don't know if there are challenges. But the other and bigger issue is they look at that and go, you know, I just really don't know if these guys know what they're doing. Why would I want to put my money there? Right? So that's important. We need to make sure that you finish the formation of the company. So you put your bylaws or operating agreement in place, and then you also have to, you know, do some basic resolutions of the board of directors or the managers, which set out the governance of the company. Who are the directors of the company? Who are the officers of the company? Those need to be elected. You need to, have issue grant the initial stock of the company? Who are the initial shareholders of the company? All of that stuff needs to be thought through and put down in writing in board resolutions in the minute book of the company in order for an investor to come in and look and say, oh, yeah, they've taken care of everything. They've crossed their I's and dotted their T's. They're ready to go.
And how often do investors look at this stuff? Or do some of them just, you know, write checks? Like maybe friends and family would just write a check and, you know, you're going to get something back. Says, okay, you bought some shares. How often do people actually get into all these documents? Or do all the angels always do that? I'm sure VCs do, but.
Well, and that's a great question. You're absolutely right that if you're taking friends and family investment, they're probably not going to care about those things. But I have yet to meet
there.
Yeah, I have yet to meet an angel investor or their representative who isn't going to at least do that amount of due diligence. Look at the corporate documents and make sure they're in order. You know, make sure that they at least know who the authorized officers of the company are and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's very basic, and I think, like I said, I haven't met an angel investor who isn't at least going to do that amount of due diligence.
Or if the angel isn't necessary, well, the angel, you know, would hire. There, at some point, if the angel is going to write a check for $50,000, I mean, I can imagine some of these angels are real angel investors. Other angel investors are like, I think in Silicon Valley, I knew some guys who were engineers in a company, and the company went public, and of course they made a fortune, and now they fancied themselves as angel investors, and they wanted to invest. I wouldn't exactly call those guys sophisticated angel investors, but they had money to throw around. But even those guys are going to hire a lawyer, I would imagine. I'm going to write a check to say $50,000 for some business, which seems to be the kind of the neighborhood of a typical angel investment is around $50,000. So they're going to hire their lawyer and spend a few thousand bucks to have the lawyer look at this company and say, are these guys on the up and up? Do they have their act together at least, basically? So if I put money in this thing, we can track it through. And at the end of the day, if they screw up, I have some recourse to repossess something or do something, I guess, you know, at the end of the day. So,
right.
So basically what I'm driving at is you're not going to get away with not doing this paperwork at some level. If you want to get financed, you got to dot the T's and cross the I's. I mean, cross the T's,
right.
Dot the I's.
Exactly. And the risk you run, the longer that you wait to do that, like I said, is if you're doing business and entering into transactions and all this stuff hasn't been done, then you're raising the question of whether any of those transactions were properly authorized and whether there's a risk from, you know, somebody coming back and saying that they weren't properly authorized, right? So, and the bigger, like I said, the bigger issue for an investor is going to be, you know, looking at that and saying, you know, this company seems to be in chaos. They don't seem to know what they're doing, and say, you know, I have better places to put my money. So, you know, I think it's very important to just get that stuff done up front. It really doesn't cost that much to get those basic things in place. And like I said, it's just going to make a world of difference when an investor comes in and is looking at that stuff before making an investment.
Yeah,
the other thing the other thing to think about is, you know, as you are offering investments or making an offering to investors, is that, you know, you also have an obligation under the securities regulations to make sure that you are giving investors enough information about the company to make their investment. So to the extent that you're not providing this information because it doesn't exist to investors, whether or not they ask for it, then you're raising it, then, you know, you're running the risk that you didn't give the investors enough information to make their investment, and maybe they have a right to rescind their investment. So there are a lot of reasons why, you know, there's a minimum amount of formation that needs to be done, and you're not done just because you filed, you know, the articles online.
Darn, I thought it was going to be easy. But what you're saying, though, isn't that difficult. I mean, there's templates out there. We've got them. You've got them, you know, where you can fill in your corporate minutes. I mean, it sounds like that's what you're doing. You've got your, you know, your articles of incorporation and bylaws and all that. I mean, that's pretty straightforward. You could edit a template and come up with that and have it all in place. Do you have to
exactly
have it
notarized? This stuff is not expensive.
Do you need that document notarized or anything? Or can you just want you to have it and have it signed off. So you sign it yourself, and obviously have your lawyer look at it. But once you just have it on file, you're good to go. Is that
right? No, there's no notarization necessary. At least not in any of the states that I'm aware of. You know, you just sign these documents. The officer of the company signs the documents, and you're good to go. I mean, this is not a complicated process. It's not an expensive process, but it's something that's overlooked all the time.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. This seems like it's such a simple thing to just have in place, and, you know, and live happily ever after. So I envision, you know, skeletons in the closet just growing. You know, like you said, you'd have all these deals done, but are they really authorized? Who knows? But it seems like you can, you know, say you've done some deals and you go and you realize, oops, we didn't do our bylaws. You can put the bylaws in place, and does that sort of, if nobody complains, there's nothing wrong, like no harm, no foul. But nevertheless, so even if you had this document in place retroactively, that's going to be okay, isn't it?
Well, right. So you can go back and you can put these documents in place and you can ratify prior transactions and all that can be done. And really, there aren't very many things in the law that can't be fixed. That said, the bigger issue, like I said, is you're trying to project an image to an investor. This is a sales process, right?
Right.
And the bigger issue is, what's the investor going to think when he comes in and looks at this stuff and it's not done? They're going to ask themselves, do these people know what they're doing? Do I want to invest in this company so much that I'm willing to overlook the fact that the officers don't seem to know what they're doing, right? I mean, that's really what an investor is going to be saying to himself when he sees one of these companies.
Yeah, we often have, you know, customers who are, you know, let's call them more engineer types, where, you know, A, the product is so brilliant, the product will sell itself, and that sort of flies in the face of the marketing people will scream about that. You know, someone's got to market this thing. But,
that's right.
You know, the product is so brilliant, it'll sell itself. And, of course, these guys are engineers, and so they aren't maybe business savvy. It's just they're really about being, I got to invent the product. I got to make the product better, add bells and whistles and do that. And so they really don't do the business, which I guess is where you and I come in, as we help these guys make sure the business, they build a real business around it. And I often advise people, as I see business plans, where the business plan is all about pitching the product. I can't say this enough, where, you know, especially the engineer types are saying, well, the product will sell itself. It's all about the product. And investors at the end of the day don't want to buy your product. They want to invest in your company, which means the difference, I say, is kind of like the difference between buying a Coke or the Coke machine. And what you're selling is a Coke machine, and they want to buy a Coke machine that works. It doesn't squeak. It doesn't have rattles and shakes. You put the money in, the Coke drops out the bottom. It's clean. It's simple. It works. And that's, to me, what the investor wants. If I'm making a crazy, quirky metaphor on this, is what the investor is looking for. At least show me a business machine that works, that delivers your profound product.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, it's funny because I hear that all the time too, right? The product will sell itself. Well, I've been doing this for a long time, and I have yet to meet, well, that's not true. There may be a couple products out there that are so intuitive that everyone knows what their benefit is, right? Those products just don't come along very often. I mean, what engineers don't understand when they say that is, of course, it sells itself to you because you get it. You get what the use of that thing is and how great it's going to be, right? But an investor doesn't. An investor is not an engineer. It isn't going to be immediately apparent to them what the use of that product is or what the market for that product is. That's what you got to sell. And you got to sell the fact that the people who are going to be going out and selling the product know what they're doing and have the expertise and the smarts to do it, right? Well, it's kind of like on a resume, right? If you hand a resume in with all kinds of typos in it, doesn't matter what your experience is, somebody's going to look at that resume and go, man, this person doesn't have any attention to detail. I'm not even interested, right? It's the same thing with a company.
Yeah. Well, that brings up employment, you know, how important, like, to an investor, they want to see what, I would imagine if I was an investor, I want to see what the deal is with each of your employees. Like, how many shares of stock they have. I want their resume, you know, and I want to know do they have a contract with the company? Do they need to have that with the company? And, of course, then we could talk about stock and their vesting and how all that works. Can you go into some of that stuff from an investor's perspective, what they're looking for?
Well, yeah. So that brings me back to the things that investors are looking for. In addition to the structure of the company and making sure that the governance is all in place, you know, another important thing that they're going to be looking for is, you know, how well have you protected your idea? This is another of the key things that they're going to focus on right off the bat. Again, maybe not those friends and families, right? But an angel doesn't have to be very sophisticated before the first question he's going to ask is, have they protected their idea? Have they created a protection around the idea that's going to allow it to create value? So, for example, you know, for the benefit of listeners who may not know what I mean by that, I mean, I think it's easy to think about, right? For example, a drug has value because you can patent it and you can get that exclusive period where only you can sell the drug. You know, it's the same for software or for, you know, some kind of mechanical invention. Those things have value because you get that exclusive period to sell your product. Well, that's what investors are going to be looking for. They're going to come in and the first thing they're going to ask themselves is, okay, have they protected this product? And, you know, I'm not an IP lawyer. They're a patent attorney. They can give you better advice on that. But from the corporate side, one thing that I like to talk to entrepreneurs about up front is, okay, let's talk about whether you actually own this idea, whether you actually own this technology. And, of course, everyone I talk to, when I ask them that question, their first answer is, yes, of course I own this technology. And we drill down a little deeper, and it turns out, oh, well, they actually had help from these five other people kind of putting the idea together. And suddenly it turns out they don't really own the product, and they don't know where two of those people are anymore. And so suddenly...
That's sound like a whole Facebook debacle, but anyway, yeah.
Right? So it's so important, you know, one of the first things you need to think about, you know, even at the same time you're thinking about organizing your company is, okay, we got to make sure we know what the IP is and we know who the owners are. You know, when I talk about this, I always like to refer to a quote by Richard Thoman, who was then the CEO of Xerox, that he gave to the Harvard Business Review back in January of 2000. He said, increasingly, companies that are good at managing IP will win, and the ones that aren't will lose. And it's so, so important, you know, making sure that we know what the IP is and we make sure we know who owns it.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So, I would imagine any investor is going to look, make sure that, because if they put money behind it, I mean, the idea down the road to the investor to make their money on this business is either you're going to sell your business to somebody else, or you're going to take it public, or you're going to figure out some way to buy this investor out. Along the way, you want to be sure that because the company is going to buy you, they're probably buying you for your technology, so they're going to make sure that what they're buying is. They're getting clear title on what they're buying. And if they aren't going to get it, that deal is going to go away. Therefore, the investor's not going to get their money out of it. Or there's going to be a lawsuit along the way. Nothing like a crimp in the act, and, you know, along the way in your business, you get a nice big fat lawsuit on your fundamental technology, then you're in trouble. Okay, I think we've covered that. Make sure you only
exactly right. And one other thing, you know, one other thing that's going to be important to them is, I talk to a lot of inventors who, you know, want to have it both ways, right? They want to keep control of the intellectual property so that if something happens down the road, they don't lose it. They keep it and they can start over and try again, right? Well, that's exactly
right.
What investors aren't going to want to invest in. They want to have that residual value in the company so that if it all goes wrong, they can try and at least sell that IP and get some of their money back out. So you're exactly right. You know, that kind of question about the intellectual property of the company is going to be one of the first things that the investors are looking at.
Okay, and then onto the deal with the people they work with. How does that? What are they looking for there in terms of employment contracts, stock options, investing, and all that? That's actually two questions.
All right, so yeah, so that's, you know, that's going to be one of the next pieces they're looking at is, and we started to talk about this. Have the officers of the company been elected? Have the directors been elected? But they're also going to be concerned about not only who those officers are, but making sure that the officers are tied up to the company. You know, a lot of these companies, especially technology companies that are very technical, the founders of the company are going to be absolutely critical to the execution of the business plan. You know, a lot more and more, you can't just plug and play officers of a company. You really got to, I mean, think of Steve Jobs, right? I mean, Apple would be nothing without Steve Jobs. And without Steve Jobs, and you actually saw that without Steve Jobs, Apple kind of faltered, right? Investors are going to want to make sure that the officers of the company are going to stick around for a while. And one of the ways that's done is through employment agreements have consequences for leaving the company. Also, stock ownership or stock option agreements that have vesting provisions that prevent the officer from having access to that equity if they leave the company early. And there are other types of agreements, right of first refusal agreements, where if one of the officers is trying to sell shares, the investor gets the right to sell a pro rata amount of shares as well. So there are a lot of ways that investors are going to be looking at the company to make sure that employment structures are employment agreements are structured to make sure that the officers are in it for the long haul and that they've got skin in the game.
And then, okay, so yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I just think of, you think of, I go to an analogy of a rock and roll band. You know, the band starts and then they fire their drummer and then the band goes on and there's the drummer. And imagine in tech companies, you've got, you know, everybody's excited. They start the company and, oh boy, we're going. And then you get a matter of creative, what do you call it, disagreement between the CEO and the CTO or a couple of people, and one person decides to leave the band. And so what happens, I mean, that's pretty much covered in stock investing. I mean, the whole thing where, you know, you and I start a business and I get 1 million shares and you get 1 million shares, but if we vest over 5 years, so if I quit after a year, then I only get really 1 million shares, but you continue on and get your full five, but my other four go back into the pot. Can you talk a little bit about that whole, the investing and how important that is to investors?
Right, exactly, and it goes back to what I was talking about. You know, if, for example, if the key engineer on some project wants to leave 6 months after an investment, that's a disaster for investors, right? I mean, engineers aren't necessarily plug and play. So you always need to make sure that your equity, the way that you grant equity to these key people, is tied up in a way that's going to incentivize them to stay with the company. And there are other things to think about too, like compensation and making sure they're adequately compensated and all that kind of stuff. But you definitely want to make sure that vesting in their option agreements or restricted stock grants is what we call them, is structured so that if they leave, you know, they don't get the benefit of being a founder of the company. Typically, that vesting is structured so that you get, 25% after a year, and then the rest vest monthly over the next 3 years. So it's a 4-year vesting period, sometimes five. The other thing is that a lot of times when investors come in, especially that first big round of financing, they will actually revisit employment agreements and stock grant agreements, and they will actually restart the clock on the vesting so that they're sure that they're locking those key people in for the long haul.
Interesting. Okay. So, all right. Wow. One of the questions, I think we've down to about 10 minutes left in the show here. You mentioned something we were talking previously about, like, who are my investors? What are you thinking there about looking at who should be your investor? Is that what you had in mind? And now
sure.
Back on the entrepreneur side, saying, okay, who do I want to invest in my company? Is that what you're talking about?
Right. Well, exactly. Who are the likely investors going to be in the company? So it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier. You know, if you're two guys opening a donut shop, the likelihood is you're not going to go get financing from a venture capital fund, right? I mean,
no.
That's not what they're investing in. That's not even the best decision for you in terms of funding. You don't need that much funding probably to get started. So you're better off, you know, in that case, you're going to get financing from friends and family, and you may need to go to a couple small angel investors who can kick in a little extra money, right? But if you're a technology, if you're a drug company, you're developing this new drug, but you know you're going to have to go through all these FDA trials over the period of years, and it's going to take all kinds of capital to get from here to there. Well, then you know that, you know, friends and family money isn't going to get you there. And angel money isn't going to get you there. You're going to have to raise a lot of money that's going to have to be patient money who can wait, you know, 5, 7, 10 years before, you know, they get the return on their investment. Well, in that case, you know that you're going to big, sophisticated investors. Now, that's going to make a huge difference on all of these things that we talked about. You know, if you are just taking money from friends and a few friends and family or a few small angels, well, then an LLC, no big deal, right? The question between LLC and C corporation, you know, you can do either one, and it really just depends on what tax outcomes you want. But if you're taking money from large sophisticated funds, well, they can't invest in an LLC. And so you know you have to do a C corporation. You also know that you're going to have to incentivize people with stock options because it's going to take you a while to really start earning money in the company and get to where you can pay people a market salary. So so all of that will affect all of these different things that we've talked about.
Cool. What just kind of down to closing here. What are some of the other big gotchas maybe we haven't covered that, you know, we need to look out for as an entrepreneur or as a business owner wanting to grow our business? What, you know, I say it doesn't have to be limited to, I want to grow my business and I need financing. I just want to grow my business. And so startup or otherwise, any other gotchas that people don't consider legally that they, business-wise, that they should consider?
Yeah, sure. So the big gotchas I see people running into are, you know, one, like we already talked about, the IP question, right? You know, making sure that you keep track of the ownership of the intellectual property is one of those big gotchas. I think the one that we haven't talked about that I run into a lot is founders are increasingly worried about keeping control of their company, and they've seen venture capital funds come in, and they're increasingly scared that those big funds are going to come in and just replace them and kick them out of the company, and they're going to lose their company, and they're going to lose the value in their, you know, in their ownership of the company. And so, you know, the only way to avoid that, and I try to step people back off that ledge, because I think that, you know, I've had a lot of clients who have told me they're not interested in taking VC money because they don't want, because that's exactly what they're afraid of. I try to walk them back and say, you know, there's no reason you're necessarily going to lose control of your company. You just need to make sure that you're smart about how you structure these agreements to make sure that you are going to have a say in the ownership going forward, and that you agree to terms you can live with that protect you from being ousted from your company, right? And all of that's going to depend to some extent on, you know, your company and your idea and how much leverage you have with investors. But, you know, hiring a good attorney to help you structure those agreements is going to make a big difference as to how much risk you have in the investors kind of kicking you out of the company and you losing control. So I think control is the other big gotcha that I would be worried about as a founder, as an entrepreneur.
How often does that really happen where the founder gets ousted? I mean, it seems to make news, certainly with, you know, large companies, and happened to Steve Jobs way back when. You know, so that's a big news story. But, you know, I see some of these magazines where it's the cover story, because if it leads, it bleeds, right? If it bleeds, it leads. And so they want to talk about the story, how this big founder got kicked out, you know. But how often does that happen? It seems to me that if I was investing in a company, and another thing I wanted to say about appealing to investors is you really got to show the investor that you've got something more interesting to do with their money than they can come up with. You know, so, I mean, if I have a bunch of money and you want me to invest in your company, you better come up with something darn more creative than me spending it on building a swimming pool or, you know, buying a jet, or you're taking a vacation somewhere. So I'll put my money in your company because you've got something interesting. But at the same time, I'm going to invest in your company. I don't want to run your company. I mean, if I wanted to invest in your company and run it, I would tell you that and say, I want to buy into this thing, and here's the job I want to do. You know, but I would imagine most investors don't want to take your company over or run it. But so I'm just curious, like, in there, how often does that really happen?
You know, it happens. I'm not going to say it doesn't happen, because, you know, I've been involved in plenty of situations where investors get fed up and just feel like they can't work with the entrepreneur anymore, the founder of the company. And you know, in that case, there aren't very many cases where the investor just wants to stick it to the founder and put them in a situation where they're completely out of the company and don't get anything. But it does happen. It does happen. Typically, though, you're right. It has to get pretty bad before an investor reaches that point. There are predatory investors out there. You got to be careful about that, and that's another reason to worry about your agreements and make sure, you know, you get some help in drafting those agreements. But for the most part, investors, like you said, they don't want to run the company. They're investing because they think you're going to do a good job running the company, and they're going to be able to get a return from that. And it actually has to get, you know, the founder has to demonstrate a fair amount of incompetence or unwillingness to work with the investors on their goals before investors get to a point where they're going to oust you.
I was going to say, it seems like it almost gets personal at that point where, you know, if you're really just plain obstinate, you're just determined to do things your way and it's clearly not working, and you refuse to try a different approach, and you're not, you know, communicating. You know, I can just imagine various and other sundry things why someone wants to. I mean, why does anybody not like somebody else? I mean, you know, it's like when you owe somebody money, that's when you really need to be on the phone and talking to them or communicating with them. Because if we don't hear from you, we assume the worst. I mean, that just seems to be human nature. If it's not going well, we don't hear anything. It's like, oh, this has got to be really bad. And so you
have
to imagine things going really badly for a company. But if you get with the founders, okay, here's what I'm doing this, we're doing this, what do you recommend? You know, you get the guys together in a room and say, what do we do? And then they go off and have lunch, and you go back to work doing the things they suggested. But if you won't, it's like, well, we need to kick you out now.
Right. Well, and that's one of the principal reasons that things go bad is investors don't see any progress being made, and there's no communication from the company, right? Their only conclusion can be that, you know, they've got to try something new. The other situation where it commonly happens is what, and it goes back to the issue of knowing who your investors are going to be. You know, The other common situation is that investors have a certain investment timeline, you know, and they expect that they're putting money in, and you're telling them that they're going to get a return in a certain amount of time. Well, if that time passes and there's no communication from the company and the founder's obstinate about, you know, doing things his way without regard to these legitimate concerns of investors, that's the other thing where things are going to go south.
Okay. Well, Matt, we are out of time, and that's a great place to end this thing on. So I hope everybody gets their T's crossed, I's dotted, listen to this show again and again to hear all this stuff. Brilliant. I really appreciate it, you know, Matt. And thank you for being here. And folks,
thank
if you
want
to find Matt Romney, he's at Kunzler Law Group in Salt Lake City, and it's Kunzler, K-U-N-Z-L-E-R, law.com. So KunzlerLaw.com, and the link is actually to your bio page, Matt, on the website here. So thank you for listening. Matt, thank you for being here. I appreciate it very much, and we are done.
Thank you.